I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday afternoon. And you know we're going to be talking about last night's final presidential debate. This hour of the show, we have two terrific guests with us. David Frum will be here, senior editor at The Atlantic and chair of Policy Exchange. In 2001-2002, he was a speechwriter for President George W. Bush. Yoni Applebaum will also be joining us this hour, politics editor and Washington Bureau chief at The Atlantic. They were watching this debate very carefully. They were tweeting about it during the course of the night, and there's been a whole lot written today about what happened last night. We'll be interesting to hear your perspectives during the course of the hour, so we'll be taking as many phone calls as we can. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well, and that's at K Dunn Show. We're going to start where you would expect we would probably start, because this is what everybody is concentrating on today. And that is what Chris Wallace asked Donald Trump about, whether or not he would accept the outcome of the election. It's been called the most important moment of the evening. This is what Chris Wallace said. This is what Donald Trump said. And we'll get response from our guests at the top of their conversation in just a moment. Here's from last night.
Do you make the same commitment that you will absolutely, sir, that you will absolutely accept the result of this election?
I will look at it at the time. I'm not looking at anything now. I'll look at it at the time. What I've seen is so bad. First of all, the media is so dishonest and so corrupt, and the pile-on is so amazing. The New York Times actually wrote an article about it that they don't even care. It's so dishonest, and they've poisoned the minds of the voters. But unfortunately for them, I think the voters are seeing through it. I think they're going to see through it. We'll find out on November 8th, but I think they're going to see through it.
But, sir, there's
If you look, excuse me, Chris, if you look at your voter rolls, you will see millions of people that are registered to vote. Millions. This isn't coming from me. This is coming from Pew Report and other places. Millions of people that are registered to vote that shouldn't be registered to vote.
And you heard during the news from National Public Radio at the top of the hour that on the campaign trail today in Ohio, Donald Trump said he would support the outcome if he wins and wanted to reserve the right for legal challenges. So we'll ask our guests what they think of that, which is obviously the headline story all over the place today. First, let me welcome David. Hello. Thanks for being with us again.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, thanks. And Yoni, thank you so much for being with us.
A pleasure to be here.
Yeah. Well, let's start with that. That's the headline story. What do you make of what Donald Trump said about that? David?
What Donald Trump said today began life as a joke. The Trump campaign released a statement with actually two versions of the remark, one of which is classic sort of good humor on the, you know, correcting your own mistake, in which Donald Trump was supposed to have said, I will accept, I want to avow that he had the long build-up to the punchline that I will accept Hillary Clinton's concession speech. Ha, 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 ha. But clearly that stuck in his craw. That was too good-natured, and he didn't want to walk back his remark and imply that, you know, maybe he'd gone wrong. So he said, the team came up with a second version, which is also in the printed statement, and that's if I win. If I win was not an ad-lib, but as I said, this was a joke. He decided he couldn't bear the joke, and he wanted to double down on this challenge to accept the rule that you accept the results of an election.
Yoni, his worst answer will also be his downfall. We'll be talking about what happens when he loses.
Yeah, so this is in a cycle when I thought we'd all grown inured to the insanity and there was nothing left to shock. Donald Trump found a new way to shock the audience last night. This was an answer that separated Trump not just from Democrats or from Hillary Clinton supporters, but from much of the institutional Republican Party. And we've been hearing, and as David just pointed out, even his own staff, some elements of it would like to push him to clarify this, to walk this back. But Trump has decided to stand and fight on this one, as best I can tell.
Is this dangerous in some way? A lot of people are making a whole lot of this, saying that he's really criticizing the very foundation of American democracy. This is simply beyond the pale. David?
Of course, it's dangerous. Look, the United States has had these things before, especially in the post-Civil War period. Bill Clinton often tells a story about a governor's race in Arkansas that was settled in bloodshed. There were challenges by the people who wanted to, basically those Arkansans who were willing to make their peace with the outcome of the Civil War, and those Arkansans who wanted to go down to the bitter end, and they had a big gun battle. I'm going to now forget which side won. But I think the pro-Union side won because the case was eventually settled by the arrival of federal troops. At the federal level, however, no, we have not seen this, and no other democracy has seen this. In fact, one of the things that defines mature democracies is that it's just not controversial. Partly because everybody understands, beat them next year. I mean, that's the ethos of modern democracy. You walk away and say, well, beat them next year.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about how the debate went last night. You were tweeting last night, David, and I would agree with you that for the first part of the debate, we seem to be seeing a different Donald Trump. He almost appeared, and I think you said this, you wondered if he was sick. When we were just listening to the voice, Scotty and I, today, he didn't sound like Donald Trump. He sounded incredibly subdued, and he seemed to be, pretty much on message for a good portion of the debate, and then it all kind of fell apart. But he seemed disciplined for a while.
Well, that's for me. In the first half hour, there were a couple of occasions where, I'm not going to remember them now exactly, Hillary Clinton needled him. And rather than accept the needle or respond, he stuck to his point. And he was, at that point, talking about immigration, which is his strongest issue. And it was, I joked, it was his most disciplined evening since 1979. But it wore through. The second half hour was less disciplined than the first, and then minute 66 is when the whole thing dissolves. It's pretty late. He's in a lot. If you're used to East Coast time, you don't want to be up all night in Las Vegas.
Right. Exactly. And Hillary Clinton seemed to have a different kind of. She was very much on him last night. It was a different kind of performance, I think, Yoni, from the last debate where she was just letting him do what he does. Yesterday, she was on the offensive.
You could see her, I think, gain confidence over the course of these three debates. He walked on to the first general election debate stage. It was the first time that he'd appeared in a one-on-one debate. I think neither Clinton nor her advisors knew quite what to expect. But she performed well. That will, I think, be regarded as something of a turning point in this race, did even better in the second debate, if not on substance of performance, than in accelerating a growing divide between them in the polls. And by the time she walked out there last night, Hillary had a game plan. She, as David points out, knew that she could needle him, and despite his efforts to resist that for the first half of the debate, she successfully distracted him by throwing jibes and little insults and sly digs at him, and is well aware that Donald Trump is frequently unable to resist or unwilling to resist answering those charges and going off message and away from the agenda that he's laid out for voters and which fueled his rise.
David, you wrote in a really good piece in The Atlantic, How to Rebuild the Republican Party. You wrote about the famous autopsy of 2013, which many seem to have forgotten. And you say anti-Trump Republicans need to remember the lesson of the autopsy as much as do pro-Trump Republicans. Electoral politics is a game of addition. What happened to addition to the ranks of Republicans?
Well, I think that autopsy back in 2013 was really a cul-de-sac for the Republican Party. It's going to get all kinds of nostalgic treatment after what is likely to happen in November, but it had the wrong answer. And this election is showing how wrong the answer is. What happened with that famous autopsy was they convened five people, three of whom had close ties to the Jeb Bush campaign, and they wrote a diagnosis of the ills of the Republican Party that was really a help-wanted ad with one candidate in mind. That was their friend, Jeb Bush. So the core Republican problem is not, in my opinion, that it doesn't do well with low-income recent immigrants. Why would low-income recent immigrants vote Republican? The core Republican problem is it is doing decreasingly well among college-educated women, a group that 25 years ago were almost as solid a Republican constituency as college-educated men. The reason Republicans don't like to talk about their woman problem is that when you look at what is alienating women from the Republican Party, you see first, it's the reactionary social message. So to bring women back, you have to rethink where the party stands on same-sex marriage and on abortion. That doesn't mean you have to stop being a pro-life party, but it means you can't be a punitively pro-life party. You have to start talking about mother's allowances and other ways to make make raising a child more attractive and easy. That's how you persuade women to make a decision at the margin between one choice and another. They didn't want to do that. And the second reason we have trouble with college-educated women is, of course, because women are usually at the point of the spear when it comes to taking care of families that are sick or troubled, and they want a more generous system of social insurance than the Republican Party has been willing to offer. So the attraction of emphasizing immigration as the issue is it allowed the party to avoid the need to have a more modern social message and more modern healthcare message. I think the lesson of this election is going to be Republicans are going to see a disastrous collapse among their vote with college-educated women. They won't do well with college-educated men either, but it's going to be, you know, a debacle among college-educated women. And they need to think, how do we get women who have economic reasons to vote Republican? How do we insult them less, and how do we offer them something that is meaningful to them?
Mm-hmm. And she was so strongly pro-women last night when she answered that Supreme Court question, Yoni. She talked about, right off the bat, she talked about standing on the side of the American people. She mentioned not the powerful corporations, but she mentioned women's rights, the LGBT community, No to Citizens United, not to reverse marriage equality, Roe v. Wade. She was very strong on not having that rescinded, the rights of people in the workplace. She came off as very strongly pro-women. Her defense of Planned Parenthood was pretty remarkable.
Yeah, it was, particularly for a candidate who herself has frequently spoken in the past about her own moral ambivalence around the act of abortion, although not the right to choose. You know, Hillary Clinton honed her message in the primaries against Bernie Sanders, and despite the immense frustration of the Clinton campaign at the time that they were being challenged from the left, one of the things that it did for Clinton was it enabled her to master the art of speaking to the Democratic Party's varied constituencies. And so she adopted the language, the phrases that each of those constituencies likes to hear. She was able to speak effectively to LGBT rights, to racial issues, to the pro-choice movement, and to do that in a way that gave her a strong message, but she didn't have to belabor the point. She just had to invoke the phrases that they often like to use themselves. And it sets up quite a contrast with Donald Trump, a man who didn't do a whole lot of debate prep, who hasn't modified his language or adopted the key phrases of the movements that make up the Republican coalition. And I think it came out on debate night where he often sounds clumsy or somewhat befuddled when he picks up language, as on the Supreme Court with the Second Amendment, that is in common currency among Republican politicians, and he doesn't quite know how to deploy it.
Mm-hmm. David, was there any way, I think of the enormous amount of attention that was paid to his comments on the bus, all the women who came forward, 9 women accusing him of groping them, very unwanted sexual assault, really, were the charges. He denied all of that. He didn't know any of those women. It dominated the news cycle, such as I wonder if there was any effective way for him to have countered this.
You mean if you were a completely different person who thought strategically and responded responsibly? Look, I mean, it's never, I mean, I imagine myself, you know, all other avenues of employment being closed to me, having to work for the Donald Trump campaign in order to save my family from begging or go to prison. So it's a pretty grim outlook, but, you know, we have to, okay, we all have kids. So there you are. What would you tell him to do? What is your best chance that maybe you can find some way to work? Well, the first thing to remember is you have to stop using this phrase sexual assault. What he's doing, remember, he's not a rapist. There's no suggestion here that, that there was violence involved. And, of course, all the women said no. I mean, it's also kind of a pathetic story. So I think a couple things. One is you need to power home the point that every woman who knows him well has great respect for him. And that means you need a character witness who's an unlikely character witness. So I think the one person who could do this job would be his first wife, Ivana Trump, a very accomplished professional woman. You know, she had, in their divorce, she had alleged that he had raped her.
Right.
If she were to come forward and say, Donald Trump has always been respectful of women, and he's a very passionate man, that's true, And in moments of he can act impulsively, but he's always kind and good, and he's always treated and he's been a wonderful father. I mean, if she were a surrogate, he'd be in better shape. Obviously, she's a better surrogate than Melania.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think he needs. Then I would suggest him that what he ought to do is emphasize. You know, he ought to show contrition, but the contrition ought to emphasize the sadness of this story. That what he has done is, you know, he responded to people in a way that made him a laughingstock, and better to be a laughingstock than a monster.
Mm-hmm. It's certainly turned. I don't know how many women, but I can't imagine he's not going to lose the women's vote significantly. Yoni, do you think?
Well, you know it. That's half the population, so I think maybe it makes more sense to split it up a little bit. There's no question that this has hurt him among, in particular, college-educated women. That's a traditionally Republican constituency, as David said before, going anywhere from 56 to 60% Republican recent presidential elections. Its effect on Trump with non-college-educated white women, who as recently as a month ago were the largest single component of his supporters, I think remains to be seen. Donald Trump is, in some sense, in his attitudes and certainly in some of his behaviors, a relic of an earlier time. Many women didn't accept this kind of behavior then and certainly won't accept it now, but others may be inclined to overlook it given other elements of his message, or maybe may have made their own accommodations with this kind of behavior if they've been subjected to it themselves. We haven't seen the same kind of erosion of support within that segment of the electorate as among college-educated women. So this may play differently, and certainly it's not the only issue on voters' minds. And for some constituents who look at this campaign and find other priorities, they may be willing to look past this because they feel passionately either that Hillary Clinton is not fit for office or that Donald Trump is offering something that they need, even if they find his personal behavior boorish or abhorrent.
We're going to go to phone calls. We have many of them coming in. We're talking about last night's presidential debate, and we have two guests with us, both from The Atlantic. Yoni Applebaum is the politics editor and the Washington Bureau chief at The Atlantic, and David Frum is senior editor at The Atlantic and chair of Policy Exchange. He was a speechwriter for President George W. Bush in 2001-2002. To your phone calls momentarily, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We're on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. If you can't make it on the air, we really like to read your messages on Facebook. It's great to see people engaged in thoughtful political discussions, so feel free to leave us messages right there. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, phone lines are full. Let's go to Dave in Menominee for our first call. Hi, Dave.
Hi, thanks. Hey, I wanted to bring up why we shouldn't be surprised about Donald Trump's remarks about not accepting the results of any election unless he wins, is what he said today. I'll accept it if I win. And this is a pattern that we've seen for well over a decade by the Republican Party. If they don't win, say, in the presidential election, they will shut down the government. They will stop everything, record filibusters. If they don't win, they will not let anything happen. And so we shouldn't be surprised that now we have a candidate who won't accept anything. If he doesn't win, and followers are there listening to him, and he, you know, it's over the line now.
David.
Well, the Republicans lost the election in 2008 and accepted it and were beaten. The reason they were able to do the shutdowns and so on after 2010, I agree that was a pretty responsible thing to do, but the reason they were able to do it was precisely because they did win. They won huge majorities in both houses of Congress. Congress also has certain powers and rights that are set by the Constitution, including powers and rights over the, of course, over the budget. So we had a conflict between two parties, each of which thought it had a mandate for very radical change, and neither of which was willing to yield to the other.
You know, what's interesting is that's true of the Republicans, but it's not true of Donald Trump, who, after we elected the first black president, demanded to see his papers. So there is a pattern of behavior here, both in Trump's disappointments in his own professional life and also in his politics, where he looks at results that he does not like and tends to regard them as rigged or fundamentally illegitimate.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about what might happen. It does look pretty likely that Hillary Clinton is going to win unless something very remarkable happens. What happens, David, you wrote about whatever else Trump did. He did confirm that a majority of Republican voters want a message that secures health coverage, raises middle-class incomes, and enforces borders and national identity. Let's talk about this middle-class incomes business. It would seem to me as though this is the pressing issue of this election. It resulted in Bernie Sanders giving Hillary a very strong challenge and Donald Trump rising to the top of the Republican field. Can you imagine a Congress and a Democratic president, and who knows which way the Congress is going to go, to be able to take on this issue that the American people are crying out for? It needs attention.
I can't imagine a Republican Congress and Hillary Clinton, President Hillary Clinton, agreeing on very much. And that, I think, was, to my mind, one of the really troubling things that on the Clinton side from last night. She must know that she is going to most likely emerge from this election as president, but with the Republicans at least holding the House, and most recent polling suggests they may well hold the Senate, too. If she wants to get anything done, she's going to have to make deals. She's not a natural deal maker. She's a much more hard-edged person than President Obama. President Obama came to office with a lot of hopes that there was a possibility for unity. She doesn't share those hopes. She's a much more hard-edged partisan than he was at the beginning. And yet she announced, I'm going to try to raise taxes. I'm going to plunge into a Obama-style approach to the immigration issue. At this point, the most divisive issue in American life. She backed away from the gun issue a little bit, and that was a question. That was something she didn't spontaneously bring up. She had to respond to a question. But what she's indicated, she's going to try to do big things and do them without a sufficient basis. And I really see a very grim scenario ahead. She is too worried at this point. She's secured her party's nomination, and yet she is still looking over her shoulder at the Bernie Sanders left. She's still thinking too much about the risk of a primary challenge in 2020, I suppose.
Oh, really? Please, are we looking at 2020 now?
Well, she is. Look, unlike President Obama, who had the trust and confidence of his party's left, and who was therefore able to move away from them on occasion in a way that Ronald Reagan could move away from the Republican right, Hillary Clinton is in very much a George H.W. Bush position. She owes her success to the party left, but they don't trust her. They're convinced she's going to betray them at the first chance, and therefore she ends up having to do more to keep them happy than somebody with more credit in the bank, more ideological credit in the bank would need to do. While she has reached out to Republicans on foreign policy issues, on the domestic policy issue, she is signaling she's going in the Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders direction, and she's going to do it without majorities in both houses of Congress. That augurs trouble.
Mm, you agree with that, Yoni?
Well, actually, I've got to go a slightly different way there. You can look at Hillary Clinton's record in the Senate when she did work notably well with colleagues on both sides of the aisle as some evidence that she understands the legislative process and is prepared to strike deals. More than that, I think that all David's absolutely right that Obama tended to see fundamental unity and Hillary Clinton is more of a hard-edged partisan. There's a flip side to that, which is that you can look at the president's legislative record and see repeated efforts to go in there and find the common ground, and then his repeated frustration when partisan maneuvering edged around that effort to find the common ground. Hillary Clinton tends not to approach things that way. She approaches things in a more partisan fashion, and one result of that is that she may be actually, ironically, better positioned to strike deals. She knows what she wants. She knows what they want. She's not under. She doesn't have the belief that Obama has that fundamentally they can all get along. And that may actually set her up for greater success in negotiating as she deals with whether it's a Republican Congress or a split Congress, or if she wins by a large enough margin, even dealing with the unruly members of the left of her own party.
Mm-hmm. David, let's talk about the Trump backers. You've written, unless their guy loses to Clinton in a 2008-style deluge, Trump backers will be much more likely to blame traitors inside the party for his defeat than their own bad judgment. Well, there are a lot of traitors inside the party because he doesn't have the support of a whole lot of high-level Republicans. What happens to those who are in Congress right now who are real squeamish about Donald Trump? And what happens to his supporters? I just can't imagine the future here.
It's a scary outlook, and I think nothing good. And you get a little taste of it from watching Sean Hannity on Fox TV. And those of your listeners who are not regular viewers of Fox and not regular viewers of Sean Hannity need to understand, Sean Hannity is actually not a Rush Limbaugh super hard-charging ideologue. I mean, he's very ideological, but he is the goat. He's a softball interviewer for Republicans. He's always in sympathy with the Republican leadership and more or less follows along where they want to go. And when if you're a Republican and you're in trouble, you go on Sean Hannity's show and he gives you an easy interview that allows you to state your case. So for him to be doing these kinds of divide the party statements, that's an indication, you know, first where he sees his personal future. Fox is a network with a great question mark over whether, mm-hmm. with Roger Ailes gone, I mean, Fox is like this double-headed beast, right? I mean, we all saw the outstanding job that Chris Wallace did in that debate. I mean, there are really serious news people at Fox.
Yes.
Matt Baer is another. They break stories. And then they have this other life. The other life is actually more lucrative than the news division. So long as Roger Ailes was around, both parties kept an uneasy coexistence. With Ailes gone, what happens? Does new management try to be more of a news network? As a way of sort of dealing with some of the after effects of the Ailes sex scandals? Where do people like Sean Hannity fit in? Do they go to Trump TV if Trump TV is born? So he's indicating that not just for ideological reasons, but for a lot of personal reasons, there are going to be incentives for a real internal Republican Donnybrook after November.
Mm-hmm. Yoni, do you have any more faith that this primary issue of this campaign, this angst about income that so many middle class and those who are not in the middle class level or haven't reached that yet are feeling, that their incomes just aren't where they should be? It's a struggle for people. Will this be addressed by whoever we elect next?
Well, I think one of the interesting questions is, what is the primary issue of this campaign? There are certainly people who see that as the stagnation of the middle class or the struggles of the working class, the lack of opportunity for people without a college education where they once could have found remunerative and satisfying work and now cannot. There are others who look here and see primarily a cultural conflict over cultural change, over an increasingly diverse nation.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that one of the things we're going to see starting already now and really kicking into full gear post November 8th is a fight over what it all meant. That is, Hillary Clinton and her supporters will try to define the results as support for her agenda. Donald Trump will define it in a very different way, I suspect, and we'll see an internecine fight within the Republican Party over what the repudiation of Trump, if the current polls hold, what that will have meant. What's tough to see emerging out of this is any kind of a policy agenda that's going to help the most vulnerable Americans. The heroin crisis is pervasive and real.
Right.
It comes up from time to time on the campaign trail, but there was not a question about it last night, and there rarely has been. The shift of much of the blue-collar workforce out of factories and onto SSDI is a real thing, and that, too, has rarely come up on the trail except indirectly. And so what I'm not hearing in this campaign is a whole lot of attention on those sorts of problems. Instead, we're talking about 20-year-old flows of trade to China and other NAFTA and other mm-hmm. old trade deals mm-hmm. that probably don't have a whole lot of explanatory power for current economic travails.
Let's go to our number is 800-486-8655. Jeff in Eau Claire. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, good morning. What I'm not hearing in this campaign is a mea culpa from the mainstream media and the bias.
absolute bias. Even your guest this morning, Kathleen, it's amazing. And you guys have no self-consciousness. Why would America elect a candidate, a woman, whose husband committed criminal acts in the White House? She ran a corrupt campaign against her opponent in the primaries, a part of an administration that sent money to a terrorist nation in Iran, supporting terrorism worldwide, the foreign policy programs that blew up under her watch in Libya and in Syria. Why would we elect that candidate president, and you people continue to sell and play her party line in the mainstream media? Years ago, Mike Reagan, when he was in a debate, said, "I'm paying for this microphone." Well, you know, there are people in Wisconsin and Minnesota and everywhere who won't pay for public radio to continue to sell this candidate and have no self-consciousness about their own bias.
Well, Jeff, you haven't been listening to us very long because we have dissected her campaign. We've been on these issues for a year and a half, and certainly during the primaries we spent a whole lot of time on this. But I hear this from some listeners that the mainstream press is really supporting a Hillary plank. Do you think part of the problem, Yoni, is that Donald Trump has moved this whole conversation in ways that may be shocking to so many that the press has to respond to them? They're just, and he knows how to play the press for that.
Well, sure. I think one thing I do is just like I did for women before. Media is a very big category. And includes all sorts of different institutions with different behaviors this election year. And often I think when I hear complaints like this, it may reflect a generalized impression and be less true in its specifics. But there is no question that one thing that this campaign has done is push the traditional boundaries of reporting. And that's wholly apart from an evaluation of Hillary Clinton's merits and demerits, which are considerable. But Donald Trump has deviated from established norms of conduct and behavior in ways that we have not seen in modern American politics. Mm-hmm. And as reporters point that out, they can be perceived as taking sides in a partisan fight. I guess what the caller really drives home to me, though, is the depth of division, the extent to which there are fundamentally, in large chunks of this country, two different narratives. Polling shows that many Americans who are supporting Donald Trump don't know anyone in their family or in their close personal friends who is voting for Hillary Clinton, and the same is true of Hillary Clinton supporters. And when that's the case, when we no longer break bread around the table with close friends or family who see the world very differently than we do, I think it's very hard not to hear an account about one candidate or about the other and not filter it through that kind of prism.
David Yoni has written, if the media coverage is rigged against Donald Trump, it was Donald Trump who rigged it. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I want to say something very specific to that caller.
So all right.
Think of the things you know about the payoffs to Iran, about the money was paid in pallets, in cash pallets, that there are gold payouts, that maybe some laws were broken, that the timing of these releases coincided with the release of American detainees. And think, how is it that you know those things? And the answer is, you know them because of Jay Solomon, who's been reporting for the Wall Street Journal, which is about as mainstream a newspaper as you get. It's true that the caller may have encountered these pieces of information in Facebook or on some other website, but it was Jay Solomon who, very underpaid and very soft-spoken reporter. I urge everyone to read his book, The Iran Wars. He broke these stories, and he broke them for the Wall Street Journal. And again, when you think, how do we know about what about the financial scandals of the Clinton years? Again, those were broken by reporters, often for the New York Times. By the way, the Clinton people are convinced that the New York Times is determined to destroy them. They think there's it's not ideological, it's personal, that the New York Times just has a special hatred for the Clinton family. So reporters do these. Reporters have biases, they have blind spots, they have things they're ready to believe and things they're ready to doubt. They're suckers for certain kinds of information and then much harder to convince of others. I don't want to idealize this occupation. But when you read it in Facebook, it wasn't because Mark Zuckerberg paid to get you that information.
Thanks for the call, Jeff. We go next to Saeed in Green Bay. Hi.
Hi, Kathleen. Thanks for taking my call. Kathleen, the big thing that people are talking about in our national media about the debate last night is Trump's refusal to clearly state that he will accept the outcomes of the election, and that's being touted as an undermining of our democracy. I will submit to you that our that the peaceful transition of power is entirely reliant on everyone accepting that the process was fair, and we have lost that in this this election.
How so? How we lost it?
We now know that the Democratic Party paid agitators to go to Trump's rallies and cause violence. They, in fact, were boasting about the fact that they shut down free speech.
Yeah, we don't. Let's get a clarification on this. We've heard these charges in the last day and a half, and they have tape. And O'Keefe is not, we don't know for sure if the tape is doctored, but obviously some things were said that were outrageous. We don't know if that actually happened. We don't know the full extent of this story yet, although it's been touted by Trump surrogates on television shows for the last day. What do we know is true? Yoni?
Well, I think at this point, our organization, like a lot of media organizations, is doing its best to report this out and to find out whether this was a single individual telling tall tales or whether this is,
right,
in fact, the disclosure of something which is germane to the election. Certainly the allegations are extremely disturbing. I think that I would hesitate at this point to go beyond what's there on the tape or even to vouch for that tape having been accurately edited to reflect the contents of the conversation.
Yeah, we need to find out what's true. Thanks, Saeed, very much for your call. Ryan in Toma, hi.
Hello. I just want to comment on a lot of these callers that are calling in. I really appreciate the way they're handling themselves because listen to this one-sided debate with you guys is really tough to handle, to take in and then still handle yourself right. But anyways, my point is I'd like to make a couple of points. First of all, Walker was recalled in the state of Wisconsin by the liberals, the liberal media. You guys were back.
Yeah, let's go to the presidential race, Ryan. We've got too much on our plate as it is. Go to the presidential race, please.
Yes, I'm getting there. Just hang on. Trump is getting backed or hit by you guys because he doesn't want to accept it. But you guys, we voted and nothing was fraudulent for Walker, and you guys don't want to accept that, so you do a recall, which costs Wisconsin millions of dollars, but you still lost because it was fair. But anyways, you said Hillary is more aggressive, so she'll get more done, but Obama made...
No, I didn't say that. I said she was more aggressive in her presentation last night.
That'd be what we really need. Hillary's ignorance of the law, nobody talks about this. You know, she doesn't get brought up at the debates, nothing happens. She whitewashed her computers. Ignorance of the law is no excuse. So.
All right, thank you. You have these conversations and you realize we're talking past each other here, David. I don't know how we come to a common ground to realize that some things may be are offensive and are not part of a campaign, and some things should be discussed, and what the truth is and what you want to believe and how your beliefs are reinforced. It's just, I haven't seen anything like this. It's pretty nasty.
Well, one of the things that we all have to do is be better consumers of the media we read and be more skeptical consumers of it. And one of the things I find very poignant, and maybe this is because I work at a place like The Atlantic, which is part of the mainstream media and has been since before the Civil War, and maybe you could even argue that is the most mainstream media of all the mainstream media. You have to be savvier about it. When things show up in your Facebook feed, you have to reverse engineer them and ask yourself, how did you get there, and what exactly do you know? And we were talking about these James O'Keefe videos. I mean, so for example, supposing that they're all true and that they're not distorted and he did present things fairly and that the people who make these statements, in fact, did what they said they did rather than just both. Supposing it's all true, what exactly is the big reveal? And the big reveal is that someone claims that he sent provocateurs to Trump rallies to goad Trump people into acting violently. But it needs to be understood that even on James O'Keefe's own showing, the violence was committed by the Trump people. The anti-Trump people showed up and they wore T-shirts they didn't like or chanted slogans they didn't like. And the fact is, you know, I hear things I don't like all day long. It doesn't entitle me to punch somebody in the back of the head.
Thanks very much for your call. Our number is 800-486-8655. We will take more phone calls in a moment. We're talking about last night's debate, and I hope we can have, you know, without accusing everybody, that we're trying to discuss with two people who write about this for The Atlantic, for heaven's sake, which has been around forever, and esteemed writers are there. And so yeah, we got the best for you here today, and we're trying to discern what happened and what the ramifications are of words that were said. And we have two guests with us. David Frum is senior editor at The Atlantic. He's the chair of Policy Exchange. He was a speechwriter for President George W. Bush, 2001-2002. Yoni Applebaum, politics editor, Washington bureau chief at The Atlantic. Back with you in a moment here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Both sides in this campaign have made much of potential Supreme Court nominees, and there could be several of them for either Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton. I thought this was a clear delineation of different principles and different guiding lights for Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton when they were asked about Supreme Court picks and their possible picks.
But I feel that at this point in our country's history, it is important that we not reverse marriage equality, that we not reverse Roe v. Wade, that we stand up against Citizens United, we stand up for the rights of people in the workplace, that we stand up and basically say the Supreme Court should represent all of us. That's how I see the court and the kind of people that I would be looking to nominate to the court.
I feel that the justices that I am going to appoint, and I've named 20 of them, the justices that I'm going to appoint will be pro-life. They will have a conservative bent. They will be protecting the Second Amendment. They are great scholars in all cases, and they're people of tremendous respect. They will interpret the Constitution the way the founders wanted it interpreted. And I believe that's very, very important. I don't think we should have justices appointed that decide what they want to hear.
We're welcoming phone calls, 800-486-8655. David in Ironwood, Michigan. Hi.
Yes, I haven't had two candidates with such high unfavorables, even with their own party. How are they going to govern? How are they going to lead the country when most of the people don't care for them?
Yeah, how did that happen, Yoni?
Well, this is a great question.
It is.
You know, I'm actually really encouraged by the calls we're getting today because your listeners are engaging. They clearly feel that they can call up. Their voices will be put on the air. They can ask tough questions of your guests and expect to get fair and considered answers. I'll worry when the phones stop ringing that people are losing faith in the process and in institutions much more than I worry about tough criticism that they have to offer now. But when I hear a call like this, a caller calling up and saying neither of these candidates seems terribly attractive to most Americans, that is worrisome to me. One thing that we see is the rise of negative partisanship. Voters from each party are now much less likely to have favorable views of the candidate from the other party than was the case until fairly recently. And then the other thing that we're seeing is two older candidates with long-established records and not uncontroversial records at that, who both stepped onto the presidential stage in bruising primaries. And that, I think, further built their negative ratings. There are very few Americans who are pleased with the choice that they'll have when they step into the booth on November 8th. And in part, at least, that's the result of a process in which a relatively small number of primary voters decides what choices the American public at large will have in November.
David, do you think that Hillary Clinton would have lost this go-around to any number of other Republican nominees?
For sure. You know, when you think about what it takes to win a third term, who's done it? Well, George H.W. Bush did it in 1988, a year of phenomenal economic growth, rapidly rising incomes after a very, very popular president. Herbert Hoover was able to do it in 1928, an even better year economically. But usually it's 8 years and out. That's the usual rule. And the American people get ready for something new. And in a way, we steer the ship of state by overcorrecting. You know, we've had 8 years of a highly of an administration, the Obama administration, highly interventionist in the economy at home, but highly nervous about expressing American strength abroad. I think a lot of people say, okay, now we correct the ship by steering the other direction. Let's have a more forceful foreign policy and a more cautious domestic policy. That is what would normally happen. The Republicans made some bad choices. The Democrats also made a bad choice. I agree with the caller who said that Hillary Clinton is a weak candidate, partly because, you know, I don't think Democrats in their ideal world would want to be arguing, have these names from the 90s and arguing about these issues from the 90s. It's time for something new. The voters move on. That's how you reach them. But the choices are what the choices are.
Tom in Wisconsin Rapids, hi.
I'd just like to commend you. The other side has Rush Limbaugh, Bader, Hannity, and all those, and you're apparently more powerful than they are. Thank you.
Thanks for the call. We don't have as many listeners, that's true. Hey, let's talk just a wee bit more. We've discussed this some, but this whole power of the media and what's happened with media, and you listen to what you agree with and you're not having your views challenged. You hear the same rhetoric from one side or the other, and there are more conservative outlets on radio, at least, than there are on television. It can't be very good for us, can it? Or do you think it's okay, Yoni?
You know, we've passed through hyper-partisan eras before. In the 19th century, very few newspapers didn't take a hard partisan line. Today, you'd be hard-pressed to find any major paper which is as closely aligned as the papers of that era were. I think we can survive this. What is more worrisome to me, frankly, than the media and the bubble in which some voters may reside is the way in which there's an atomization of American society itself. So less that they may not encounter media outlets which challenge them or their views, more that, we found in the primary a strong corollary of Trump support was lack of any civic engagement. Not just not going to church, but not going to the PTA, not going to Little League, not being involved in communities led voters, on the Republican side of the aisle at least, to embrace a candidate who vowed to change the status quo. And correlated with very strong frustration at the system. So, it's not just about the media we consume. It has to do with the social relationships that we build, the likelihood that we'll have strong personal bonds with somebody with whom we disagree. And when it is your brother-in-law, they may drive you nuts with the radio shows they listen to or with the views that they espouse, but at the end of the day, they're your brother-in-law, and you love them, and you've got to reconcile the fact that people you love disagree with you about fundamental things, and that is healthy for a democracy. And when communities drift apart, when people disengage from their own communities, that typically is less healthy and may be much more worrisome than the polarization of media outlets per se.
Yoni has written, David, and I wonder how you respond to this, because this does seem like a significant change in America. If Hillary wins with substantial majorities of votes from women, blacks, Hispanics, quite likely with support from only a minority of white voters, it will signal a Democratic shift that may prove irreversible. If that indeed happens, how do Republicans respond to that, and what does that mean?
Well, there's a question of how do Republicans respond and how does the country respond. We are going through a period of very rapid demographic transition.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a choice, by the way. It's not happening because of some act of nature. It's happening because of a series of policies decided by government. The pace of change could be slower, could be faster. These are stressful times. I think the people who make these decisions don't appreciate how much it stresses societies to go through these kinds of demographic changes. We have been running most rapid change since before the First World War. It's now about to accelerate beyond even the levels of the 1890s and 1900s. It is not surprising that evokes a lot of bitter feelings. How do you adjust? I mean, the Republican Party has to go looking for who are the voters who are reachable for us. And in particular, my advice would be they have to think, how do we get men and women of similar economic backgrounds to vote more like one another. And that becomes challenging at a time when marriage is in decline, when men and women are less likely to be living together and less likely to have those basic household interests in common.
Are you worried about voter intimidation, Yoni?
You know, one thing we've seen with the Trump campaign is that it's not terribly well organized. We've seen other presidential candidates who have inspired lots of local organizing committees and people to knock on doors and people who plant flyers at every stoop in their neighborhood. The Trump campaign has not inspired that kind of small unit organizing. Although certainly some of the rhetoric is extremely worrisome, neither on Election Day nor after Election Day, there simply don't seem to be the local groups to mobilize that would be required to really create an issue there, which is not to say that it can't happen in isolated incidents, but this is just not a campaign that has inspired that kind of grassroots activism at any substantial level.
Yeah, I guess you could say it's a campaign that has inspired a whole lot. It's just been a rough one. Thank you both so much for being with us. I enjoyed the hour. Thank you. David Frum and Yoni Applebaum from The Atlantic. We thank them for being with us this hour. And direct you, I think we'll put these on our Facebook page, too. They've both written really good articles that appear in the current issue of The Atlantic, and we'll put that on our Facebook page. The Kathleen Dunn Show, I know many of you didn't have a chance to get on the air because we had two guests, so if you want to leave your comments there, civil comments, please. We would like very much to hear from you. That's The Kathleen Dunn Show. Thanks to Scotty Myers for producing this hour, and thanks to Scotty for on-air production here in our Milwaukee studios. Coming up the second hour of our program, Ann Basting will be with us, a UW-Milwaukee theater professor who recently won, how about this, a MacArthur Foundation Fellow. She became one and got a genius grant for her groundbreaking storytelling and theater methods that help those suffering from getting old and from dementia. So she's with us, hour two of our show.